On the Bechdelcast, the questions asked if movies have women in them. Are all their discussions just boyfriends and husbands, or do they have individualism? The patriarchy's effing vast. Start changing it with the Bechdelcast.
Hello and welcome to the Bechdelcast. My name's Jamie Loftus.
My name's Caitlin Durante.
And this is our podcast in which it's really long and it really seems like it's heading somewhere. And then at the last second, we tell you we're British.
Oi! It's oi, governor!
Den of Thieves heads will know. I'm like, I don't... Mm. Are there Den of Thieves heads out there? I have to... there's a lot of dads out there. But this is our podcast about movies.
It is. We take an intersectional feminist approach to analyzing movies, using the Bechdel test as a jumping off point, which of course is a media metric created by queer cartoonist Alison Bechdel, sometimes called the Bechdel-Wallace test. Our version of this test is as follows. Two people of a marginalized gender have to have names, and they have to speak to each other about something other than a man for at least two lines.
I think we just added a caveat, though, because if it is O'Shea Jackson suddenly having a British accent, it does automatically pass the Bechdel test.
Correct.
There are, of course, it's a complicated, ongoing conversation about
media literacy. It's always evolving. It's always evolving. It's always growing. there's a lot of caveats that we keep including, and that is, yes, that is a very important one. I think you'll agree.
I agree. but today we are going to do something a little different than we normally do, because we have an incredible guest that we want to talk about her most recent work before we kind of get into today's movie, which is yes. Den of Thieves, which is the longest movie in the entire world. Even though it's not the longest movie I've ever seen, it felt so long. And it is in, like, I feel like it's a propaganda trend for the whole movie to appear like sepia tone for reasons. I don't know.
Certain subgenres of propaganda do that. Yeah.
It's a thing. But first, we really wanted to spotlight our guest's work. She's really amazing. So let's get her in here.
Yes, let's do it. She is a freelance reporter. She is has covered, currently being released, a story in Knock LA entitled A Tradition of Violence, The History of Deputy Gangs in the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department. It's Cerise Castle.
Welcome.
Hi.
Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, of course. Thanks for being here.
We're super excited to talk to you about your work and this. It's going to be 13 parts. Is that correct?
Yeah. So that was our original plan. This week, a bunch of information was released about the Banditos gang. On Monday, there were some additional names attached to a lawsuit that was brought by a deputy against the Banditos gang at the East Los Angeles station. So that's sort of adding to my plate. So that series might get a little bit longer, just depending on, what happens. But as of now, yes, 13 parts.
That's wow. Incredible. I mean, as of this recording, 5 parts are out, and it's so well reported. Thank you so much for doing it. I know how much labor had to have gone into it, and I want to make sure that our listeners sort of have a baseline of knowledge of what the series is about. So could you tell us a little bit about how you went about reporting this, and kind of what the arc of what you're talking about in this series is?
Yeah, so this started when I received a list of litigation that the County of Los Angeles keeps track of cases that were brought where deputies were alleged to be involved in deputy gangs. And from that case, it's about 60 different cases totaling about $55 million in settlements. I just started looking into the different deputies that were involved in those cases, and it turned out that they had been involved in other shootings and other beatings and all other kinds of crime. And from there, I started putting things together and was able to sort of figure out the history of deputy gangs in Los Angeles County. They've been in existence since at least the early 1970s. And over that time, they have cost taxpayers at least $100 million in settlement money from people that they have killed or beaten or otherwise physically harmed. The deputy gangs have a lot of influence. They generally are, their members are in positions of power at different stations throughout the department, so they can be in charge of things like scheduling, who gets promoted, who goes out to what call, when, who gets backup, who doesn't. They essentially run the department. We know of about 18 different gangs that are present throughout the department. There's probably more that we don't know about, but we have been able to come up with solid reporting on 18 different gangs, and we are releasing what we found in this series that we'll be running through the end of the month.
It's incredibly well reported, and the way that you're kind of laying it out historically of how far things go back, and it quickly becomes a very depressing, you know, what is like the corkboard with 500 strings attached. Because there is, I mean, there is so much overlap in the, and you continue to see people who have murdered people being promoted, and your piece from today that I thought was fascinating and very bleak was that internally any whistleblower who even attempted to speak out against something like that internally would be, it seems like, consistently punished and never promoted.
Right.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say that's the case for most of the whistleblowers. I mean, there were some cases that, you know, I know about that unfortunately, I wasn't even able to report on because they're under protective seal. That's an interesting element for a lot of these cases, you know, because so many of them are settled, 9 times out of 10 they settle, a lot of this information remains secret. When it doesn't go to trial, that stuff remains sealed, whereas when it does go to trial, it becomes public record. So a lot of these whistleblowers, when they settled, the department had them sign agreements that they cannot speak about the terms of their settlement, their case, you know, what their agreement was, etc. So there's a lot more dirt there that, unfortunately, it's very difficult to find out about.
That's and the fact that you have been able to report so much based on what is available, which sounds like a fraction of what actually has happened, speaks a lot. I'm curious about the process of reporting this story, and I feel like that it will be interesting to our listeners as well. I mean, I think you're sort of just referencing it, but what were the sort of roadblocks you were coming up against in the process of reporting this story over the past, is it 6 months?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I think probably the first roadblock, one that I was quickly able to get over thanks to the help of Knock LA, is just the cost of this stuff. I mean, all this stuff is public record, but you still have to pay for it, and that quickly adds up. Just reporting this piece cost about $3,000 alone. And there's a lot more that I want to continue to do, so it will cost more money. But I think, you know, that's one thing that people don't really think about is, you know, just like the access to this stuff. It's very hard to get, like, for me, a journalist, like, not to just like think how hard it might be to a family that's trying to, you know, navigate the system and, you know, get some kind of justice for their loved one. Another roadblock that I ran up against is just, you know, these files have a habit of strangely disappearing. Even though these records are supposed to be kept, several of them had been destroyed. when I went down to pick them up, and I never really got a full explanation of that. The clerk said it had been a mistake or an unusual occurrence, I believe was the term that he used, but there were several files that had been destroyed, or they just couldn't locate that they were supposed to be in the courthouse, and when I went down there, the clerk just couldn't find them. I've also had just like crazy sort of scenarios happen when I've tried to pick things up. Like I was trying to pick up something that was on microfilm, and the person working told me that the water main in the basement of the courthouse had broken and destroyed all the microfilm, and I would have to write a letter to the county explaining why I needed it, and then the county would decide whether or not to grant my request. And that's something that I'm still dealing with, but yeah, it can be really crazy trying to just like deal with, you know, getting your hands on public records. There's always some like random obstacle that will pop up in your way, and it's not always clear why that's happening.
Yeah. It's always, I mean, it is always so, it doesn't feel like it should be legal to charge such high rates to access what are, I mean, then it's almost like, well, I hesitate to even call it public records if they're not available to anybody, and introducing that cost barrier is such a huge thing. And it sounds like, you know, based on what you're just describing, that it's a full-time job, like getting your hands on these records. And it's, of course, especially with families and friends of people who have been victimized by the police, they, like, not everyone has that time, you know. It's like everyone has to live their lives, and that's so frustrating. I'm glad that you were able to, you know, kind of get as much as you did, but that sounds incredibly frustrating and complicated.
Oh yeah. You have to like make appointments to go down there. Everything is time limited because of COVID protocols, which adds a whole other layer. Sometimes if your record is past a certain year, they just won't give it to you. And that's something that I'm dealing with right now. There are some records that I wanted that they're past a certain cutoff date, and because that they're in a room that is reserved for old records, I've been told that they're just not going into that room because of coronavirus, and there is no end date to COVID, so they're telling me that there's theoretically no date that they'll be going into that room, which is illegal. But you know, like I said, you get all kinds of crazy things when you're trying to navigate that.
Yeah, especially it's like, I don't even understand that argument of like, oh, coronavirus is lurking in that room no one goes into. Like, it doesn't make sense.
Yeah, it sounds like an excuse. It sounds like a lot of these, quote, public records are, like, public with a lot of caveats.
Yes.
Yeah.
To get into a little more, I really appreciated how I, at the beginning of, and we're going to link all the pieces for if you're listening, it will be linked in the description of this episode, but you open each section by listing what the legal definition of a gang is, and then each installment sort of you know, unpacks another element or incident that the LASD gangs have committed. So I wanted to just read that definition, because I know that particularly it seems like older people sometimes have difficulty wrapping their head around gangs within the police, and they're like, well, how could that be? And you lay it out at the beginning of every single piece. So it's, oh my gosh, it's under section 186.22 of the California Penal Code. A criminal gang is described as any organization or group of three or more people that, one, has a common name or identifying sign or symbol, two, has as one of its primary activities the commission of one of a long list of California criminal offenses, and three, whose members have engaged in a pattern of criminal gang activity either alone or together. And so, of course, the sheriff's gangs you're reporting on very much fit that description. So I wanted to ask for our listeners who aren't really aware, what are the kind of through lines of activities that happen within these gangs, and just kind of common patterns that you identified throughout the reporting process?
Yeah, the one, you know, commission of crime that we've seen in, you know, almost every gang that we've covered is, of course, murder. Mm-hmm. You know, we've also seen extortion of other deputies in the station. They'll hold these, what they call fundraisers, where it's unclear where the money is exactly going, and they'll pressure their colleagues into giving them money. Paul Tanaka actually had this special cigar smoking club at the sheriff's headquarters, and you could get in if you gave him $500. That's a big one. They regularly beat people up. I've heard accounts of rape. It's really anything.
It's in particular I think it's the third piece, Linwood's Worst Nightmare, that details the crimes of the Vikings gang is, you know, heavy content warning, but was just so completely eye-opening for me. That those were crimes that I had never heard about before, and it seems like it was just they were absolutely rampaging and targeting, you know, black and brown people in Linwood nonstop for weeks and months.
Yeah, that the Linwood stuff, I mean, that went on for years. And one thing that really makes me really upset is just hearing about hearing from some of the deputies that participated in this stuff. You know, one guy that I wrote about in that piece was Cliff Yates, who went on to be involved in the beating death of a man at Men's Central Jail about 12 years ago, almost to the day. That man's name was John Horton. And Cliff Yates, you know, he went on to have, he was promoted within the department. He retired and receives a six-figure pension. He lives in Florida. And as far as I know, he was never really disciplined for any of the incidents that I know that he was involved in. Mm-hmm. He's written a book where he details his career as a law enforcement officer over the past 30 years. He describes police work as hunting for humans. And he's just like, I'm very frightened, really, by how someone can view their work in a way like that, like how they can look at the terror that they inflicted on a community in such a distorted light. It really frightens me.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah. I don't know, it's just the normalization of that attitude. It's like, I don't know, something that you know, but then just hearing it come out of someone's mouth, and to know that they're absurdly wealthy, you know, and they're like still living on the taxpayer's dime after not being held to account for murder, and now they're, you know, living in a mansion in Florida or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. That they're doing. That piece in particular really was, I mean, it's disturbing, like the way that in the way that it's laid out. Another question that I had, were there any, I guess in the process of reporting this, were there any moments where you truly like, is there like one moment that kind of sticks out, one interview, just because I know it was such a long process.
I would say probably there are several moments that stick out. Mm-hmm. And I would say the ones that really stick with me are when I contact a family. Mm-hmm. To tell them that the person that killed their loved one killed somebody else. And that really sucks. And that's probably like what sticks with me the most, just being that like bearer of bad news. And just like having to like tell them that, you know, like your case didn't really make a difference. Nothing yeah. changed. This person was promoted. This person is still on the streets, like doing the same shit that he did to your family. Mm-hmm. And that just like really brings the story home to me. I mean, that's like, you know, why I did it. I mean, this stuff has been going on for years. I've been hearing about gangs in the sheriff's department since I was a kid. So, you know, I hope that by talking about it and bringing more attention to this, we can hopefully see some changes in the structure.
Absolutely. I mean, I sincerely hope that this series ends up having a demonstrable effect, because there's just so much. It's overwhelming. I'm that sounds incredibly emotionally taxing for everyone. I mean, yeah, for you and for the families, and it's just absolutely brutal. But I'm glad that it's, you know, there's being light shed on it. And so I guess to kind of close out, unless there's stuff we haven't touched on that you would like to, what do you, you know, by the time this series has concluded, what do you hope people take away from it, or what effect do you hope that the series has?
Well, I mean, I'd love everyone in Los Angeles County to have read the series. I don't know how realistic that is, but that would be my dream. I would love everyone in LA County just to like be aware of what's happening in the department, because, you know, I really think this has been able to be an open secret for the past 50 years, and I think we really need people actively engaged and talking about it. That would be my primary goal. I'd love to see the Board of Supervisors call me in to talk about my reporting, and, you know, I'd love to help them with an investigation. I'd love to assist like anyone with an investigation. I'm happy to turn over what I know. That's what I'd love to see. I think at the very minimum, there needs to be an audit of the department, at the minimum. And there are people that have been in this space for a lot longer than I have that have come up with some great solutions, that, you know, if people are so inclined to engage with that, like, I'd really recommend checking them out, like the Check the Sheriff Coalition, for example. Mm-hmm. I'd love to see more people tapped in with them. That's what I'd love to see.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would recommend, I mean, even if you live outside of LA County, it's the lessons and that you and what you can take away from having read this series is applicable to anyone, you know, living in a place with a sheriff's department. Like, the LASD is egregiously bad, but it's not like, you know, these crimes are beholden to LA. Like, it's widely applicable reporting that everyone should definitely check out. And I do think it's great that Knock LA was able to help fund and publish it as well, because it seems like the kind of report that, you know, could only be done at an independent news source, where it seems like there's always so many blockages when you're working with a huge mainstream source, which I know you have.
I just think that they don't want to do it, to be perfectly honest with you.
Speak to that. I'm so curious what your thoughts on that are, because I know you've worked on kind of both sides of that line.
Yeah, I mean, just to be candid, I mean, this information has been out there for the past 50 years.
Right.
Major institutions have had the funding to go after this information. They've had the access to the information. The reason that they didn't do it, and from where I'm standing, is it just wasn't an interest. This affects Black and brown people. This affects low-income people. And those aren't communities that newspapers have seen, or not just newspapers, but that major media outlets have not viewed as a priority, really ever. So that's why it didn't get done. It's the same reason that the Grim Sleeper, a serial killer in South Los Angeles, was able to terrorize the community for almost 40 years and kill with impunity. That never really got any news coverage. It's the same reason why deputy gangs in those same neighborhoods don't get any news coverage.
Absolutely. Thank you for your insight on that too, because it's shocking just reading through your reporting how, you know, like it would have taken reporting and funding, but like you say, it's not like there's ever been any shortage of available funds to do that. It's the willingness and prioritizing Black and Brown people in reporting, which just doesn't seem to ever happen in mainstream reporting. Is there anything else you want to hit on before we kind of start transitioning into Den of Thieves stuff?
Yeah, I would just say, you know, please check out the series. And, you know, we talked about how expensive this is. If you're so inclined, like, please send a dollar or two to the NOC Patreon. I'd love to continue doing this research, and, you know, any help I can get is much appreciated.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I guess I should full disclosure and say that I write there as well. I was like, I don't know what the right point in the episode to put it is, but it's now.
Wow.
Yeah, so yeah, I guess
just,
sorry, go ahead.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you again for doing this reporting and putting in all of this time and effort to shed light on this thing that I'll admit I really didn't know anything about until I started reading your piece. I knew about, you know, corruption and racism and violence inflicted on different communities by law enforcement, but I didn't know the extent to which there were like things you could, like, you can classify as gangs operating in the sheriff's department. So I was just like, oh, well, I mean, it makes sense, but I just didn't know anything about it. So yeah, thank you again for doing this reporting and shedding light on this.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
So to kind of transition into what, into like getting us to Den of Thieves stuff, because there's so much to talk about there. We really want to talk with you about how cops are presented to us in media. It's something we've talked about in the on the show before, but I don't think extremely in depth. And yeah, I guess I'm just kind of curious of your your opinion on how particularly movies for our purposes, but how media has very deliberately shaped what our view of cops and in this case specifically the sheriff's department has been over the years.
I've been watching a lot of cop media while reporting this piece. I've just really been living with it. My favorite is like
God, hell.
I don't know. I've really like solidly in like corrupt cop world. My favorite show right now is The Shield, which is a whole other thing. But yeah, one thing that really fascinates me about how cops are presented in all of these cases is that they're always sort of given this personality of like the hard charging, like badass rule breaker. They're never like, we never hear a story about a quote unquote like good cop who like does everything by the book, you know, has like a good relationship with their community. It's always these like assholes that are shooting everybody, and like that's accepted as really cool in the world that they live in.
It's so, and it's like, even there's a moment in Den of Thieves that I will get to where it's like, yeah, if a cop is like doing something by the book, like everyone just calls him a dork and they like call him a loser and make fun of his shoes and then continue to break the law. It's
yeah.
wild.
Yeah, the framing of a lot of like just movies and media about cops is, yeah, you're totally right. It's like these, you know, I don't play by the rules kind of law enforcement.
Cowboy shit that like right. they're kind
but,
of.
But they're still framed as like the heroes who do this competent police work and who save the day and who catch the quote bad guys and, you know, just like all the framing of this, which it is like straight up propaganda, this, you know, this. And I didn't even, I fell for it for so long. And it's just like, oh God. And Den of Thieves, I mean, we'll get into it, but it's doing a lot of the same stuff that we've seen before.
Except it's 5 hours long.
Except it's so long and like
it's so absurdly and then he's British at the end. And then I feel like we all really learned something.
Well, should we take a quick break and then come back and get into the movie? All right, we'll be back in a moment. And we're back.
We're back. So yeah, I Den of Thieves is, I mean, ripe for discussion of how cops and how specifically the LASD is portrayed in media. Cerise, you definitely know way more about this than we do. Is this, does the LASD, are they like, I know the LAPD comes up in movies and media constantly, but does the LASD come up very much in media that you know of?
Yeah, I've actually started compiling a list of LA law enforcement in media. As far as LASD, to my knowledge, they have a documentary about them called LA County 187 that was produced for TV, I believe, in the late 80s, early 90s. Den of Thieves, of course. And there's a recent movie out with Jared Leto and Denzel Washington called The Little Things, which is and Rami Malek. And that's about the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department as well.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything you've seen that you feel like, I haven't seen The Little Things yet. I forgot that it came out, honestly. But like, are there any portrayals of the LASD that you think have been appropriately critical that has come out? Or is it mostly kind of like badass cop stuff?
I've never seen anything critical of law enforcement in a movie or television show. I mean, I like to say that The Shield is satire, but my girlfriend just sort of rolls her eyes at me and walks away when I bring that conversation to the table.
It's a galaxy brain take. Yeah, I was thinking about, I was going through just kind of like the list of episodes we've done that I was like, oh, the protagonist of this movie is like a nice, like even movies like fucking Fargo, you're like, oh no, I've been duped into thinking that like, well, cop is woman now, so it's all so it's okay. It's all good. It's like, oh yeah, what a fool.
The media around a sheriff's department, not the Los Angeles one, but that I've been most exposed to has been Reno 911, which is a show that I do love and think is very funny. But it's like one of the things that duped me where I'm like, oh, this show about these sheriffs, they're all such lovable goofs, tee hee. And that's probably not how they actually are in real life.
Yeah, it is over, like it's genuinely overwhelming of how much propaganda there is and how many genres it spans, because like you were saying, Caitlin, like there's cop comedies and there's like, you know, there's kind of the Den of Thieves genre of like sepia toned intense glorification of being a horrible cop. And then there's like the procedurals, it's so pervasive that it's, I don't know. Yeah, I got, I became overwhelmed by it. And then there's literally the show Cops, which is like every, my uncles love it so much and it's so harmful and scary. But yeah, so today we're kind of zoning in on, I guess this is like more of what I think of automatically when I think of Copaganda, is like the Den of Thieves vibe of the badass cop who, he can't leave his work at work. And there were like moments in this movie where I guess I was like kind of like you watching the S.H.I.E.L.D. series, where like, are they trying to say something critical? But then in the next scene, you're like, oh, just kidding. He's amazing. He just drinks a little bit. Like, it's just so, it's a lot. Let's talk about it.
Yeah. Well, I guess, is the, should I just do the recap? Then we'll discuss.
Yeah, Cerise, feel free to jump in during the recap. I can't tell if this movie has a really convoluted plot or if it's like three sentences long.
The plot doesn't make any sense. There are several like key plot holes, like the first being that O'Shea Jackson like couldn't have joined the Marine Corps with a juvenile criminal record. Like,
right.
That's right. I didn't even think of that. Yeah. That's...
Also, there's so many like convenient things that happen.
Yeah.
Like the ordering of the food and getting delivered and the exact right time. Like, I don't know.
Anyway. Yeah.
So here's the story that doesn't make a lot of sense.
By Christian Gudegast. I liked that it's an auteur piece by Mr. Christian Gudegast.
And we're like, who?
Yep.
So the movie opens with like text on the screen with statistics that say that in Los Angeles, which is the bank robbery capital of the world, banks are robbed 2,400 times a year. We see then an armored car being robbed. The cops show up. There's a big shootout between the gang of robbers or the Den of Thieves. And yeah,
wow.
Them and the police and the Den of Thieves manage to escape with the armored car. And their leader is Ray Merriman. 50 Cent is also there playing a character whose name I never figured out.
My favorite part about the 50 Cent character is that at one point, because he like works out in his garage and you see he has a Stadium Arcadium Red Hot Chili Peppers poster. I was like, wait a second.
That's in my notes. I was like, whose poster is that?
The Stadium Arcadium poster blew my mind. I was like, is 50 Cent my brother? Like, what is going on? Loved that little character detail. He's a Red Hot Chili Peppers fan.
His name, hang on, let me look at IMDb. His name is, Ensign Laveau. Okay.
Oh, Laveau. So, okay, yeah, that's Laveau. I did know that.
Yeah. And then Donnie is also there. That's O'Shea Jackson Jr. There's also this guy named Bosco. So that's the Den of Thieves. Then we cut to Big Nick, a.k.a. Gerard Butler.
Phantom of the Opera himself.
Wait, that is who? Oh my gosh, that completely slipped my mind.
Yeah, it's the unfortunate truth that he played the Phantom of the Opera really badly.
Holy shit, I don't know who I thought it was, but I did not remember it being Gerard Butler. Wow.
Gerard Butler and I, sorry to unsettle you with that, by reminding you that.
I'm so broken right now. Gerard Butler and I was an extra on a movie that he was the star of. If anyone remembers, I think it was called The Bounty Hunter.
Oh, yeah.
Jennifer Aniston's also in it. I was an extra in that movie. You're welcome, everybody.
Honestly, congratulations. Post thank you so much. Screenshot. And,
Gerard Butler and I did make eye contact on that set for a brief moment. And that's my story about Gerard Butler. Anyway,
his career is very all over the place. There's just like a lot going, because wasn't he in that movie P.S. I Love You? Was that him, or is that some? I remember, yeah, like, that
the
movie.
Dead Irish guy.
Yes. Oh, he was like dead husband, and damn, that movie was really forced down my throat in like middle school or whenever it came out.
He's like, also God. In. There's a rom com. It's called like The Ugly Truth or something with Katherine Heigl. I want to say is in it.
God.
Yeah, he's got Remember range Catherine is what we're Michael? Saying
wild yeah he's it's but it's like he really he's bad he's been bad in every genre. It's really interesting. He's a great
he's
example
also
of
the 300
failing
guy,
upwards
right?
over and over.
Yeah,
yeah,
this is Sparta.
Yeah.
he's really blown it in so many different genres. I almost respect it. It's
wow.
Yeah.
Okay, so anyway, Big Nick is the head of major crimes of the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department, I think. I don't know what anyone's like title is, but he's in charge of this investigation. He goes to the crime scene. We learn that the armored truck that the Den of Thieves stole was empty. And so they're like, well, why would they steal an empty truck? What's going on? And how did they know about the drop-offs and the routes and all this stuff? And then they know of Merriman. If what is his name? Merriman.
Merriman and his Merriman? Band of Merrymen.
Reminds me of, do either of you remember he was like in a bunch of Disney Channel original movies? Ryan Merriman. He played the little leprechaun in Luck of the Irish. That's who I was thinking of the entire movie.
Wait, that actor is in a bunch of DCOMs?
He said, like, old ones. Like, he was in Luck of the Irish. I think he was decapitated in Final Destination 3, amongst other. Those are his top two credits I could think of.
Yeah, of course. Wow, okay. So, they know about Merriman, and they think that he might be behind it. He might be, like, behind this robbery.
Mm-hmm. Where did they get his name from? Like,
we don't
they
know.
Literally just were like, what if it's Merriman? Like, what?
I did not even think. I was like, I guess I just didn't question it. But they did, like, they just
knew.
What could that be a reference to?
Yeah, he's famous. He's a famous Den of Thief. So then Nick pays a visit to Donnie, who the cops know to be an associate of Merriman. Not really sure how they know that either, but anyway, Nick and his deputies interrogate Donnie, and Donnie breaks and tells them that he is in fact
a driver.
They kidnap him. Yeah,
they taser him. They kidnap him. Yeah. Take him to a hotel room where they're partying with some sex workers.
Mm-hmm.
Sex workers who are unceremoniously, I was like, I don't even think they got featured extra. Like, they unceremoniously they're dismissed from the scene without ever having said a word. They're just, and they were just guided out. And you're like, oh, okay.
And they are the first women who even appear on screen in the entire movie, and it takes about 20 minutes for them to show up. So until then, it's just a lot of toxic men. And then it's still a lot of toxic men after that. But sometimes you see a woman sprinkled throughout a scene. Nick abducts and interrogates Donnie. And Donnie breaks and tells him that he is a driver for Merriman. And he tells him about a previous job they pulled together. And then Nick lets Donnie go. And he's like, we'll be in touch.
Another thing I want to bring up is that in that scene, he shows Donnie his regulator tattoo.
Yes.
Which...
Okay, let's because I felt like those early scenes were the most specific to the LASD. Break it down for us.
Yeah. So, I mean, that whole interrogation thing, like, I've read through, reviews that the county puts out of incidents that officers get in trouble for. And that's, like, not too far off from some real instances that I've read about with LA County Sheriff's deputies. The tattoo, I mean, that's a real deputy gang. The Regulators is a deputy gang that operated out of the Century Station. Yeah, I mean, all of that is very, very true looking, very not too far from reality. that's how these deputy gangs get down.
Mm-hmm. It's so, and it's like the way it's presented is so bizarre too, because it especially after reading your reporting, you're like, oh, this is something that could conceivably have happened, but we're not supposed to think it's bad. Like, it's the way that it's right. framed to the viewer is so manipulative and bizarre, even though it seems like it's showing some pretty true to life potential interactions.
Yeah.
I almost like missed it the first time I watched the movie. He was just like, see my tattoo? We're what you might call part of a gang. And then
that's
like the only reference.
We're a clique, which is the term that, you know, people in law enforcement currently use when they're talking about these gangs. Like, they're very happy to admit most of the time under oath that they're a part of a clique, a deputy clique. So yeah, I mean, that was very true to life. Two things that he said that I wrote down was, we just shoot you, it's less paperwork. Which, I mean, yeah, I mean, attorneys have told me as much, that it's easier for these deputies to kill people rather than have them live when they live. I've had an attorney say to me, that's the deputy's worst nightmare, because they can challenge the police's narrative of them being in fear for the life, and it just makes things a lot harder. So yeah, that attitude is very true to life. He also tells Donnie, you're not the bad guys, we are.
Mm-hmm. Which is, again, it's like, it's so, it like made my head hurt. I'm like, because if you see that on paper, you're like, oh yeah, that seems to be pretty accurate. But the way that the movie frames it, and the where that like exists in context with the rest of the story, makes it seem like this like bizarre joke. It's
right.
So
I kept
strange.
I kept expecting like the arc of the rest of the story to go very, very differently, that like you'd see more examples of them being the bad guys in a way that like the movie is actually framing them as being the bad guys, but the movie frames them as like, nope, they're good at police and they're the people you're supposed to be rooting for. I think I don't know who you're supposed to be rooting for in this movie, actually, because it I found no one to be redeemable.
No one was redeemable, but I mean, I definitely wasn't rooting for the regulators. Right. I mean, I think as far as like when we're looking at like who did the most harm, like I think the Den of Thieves like hurt a lot less people, right? I think Donnie's worst crime was, you know, giving those two poor women some expired Chinese food.
Right.
It does seem like they were mostly, I mean, it was like the crimes were victimless. They were taking money. Oh, maybe that's, wait, I just had a moment. I think I know why he's called Merryman. Is it like, isn't that a Robin Hood thing?
Yes.
Robin and taking from the rich and giving to the Oh, my 7th grade English teacher is so thrilled right now. Yeah, it's like that they were not hurting anybody in their or at least originally it seems like, I mean, and the regulators are throughout the plot like hurting people at least if right. But they you know, like your introduction to O'Shea Jackson in any detail is him being abducted and physically harmed and all sorts of offensive, like they say racist stuff to him, they say homophobic stuff to him, it's just
they mock his body in a really weird way.
Yeah.
It's so like they're, but then the marketing for this movie. So I think that was, I would be really curious to know the editing process for a script like this, or like if the original draft of this script could have potentially been more ambiguous, I guess, than what you kind of end up with. But the marketing definitely wants you to think good guys versus bad guys. Like even down to the way that the poster is designed, it's the bad guys are like, in like they're upside down, and the good guys, aka, as the movie would have you believe it, the regulators, are like in the kind of dominant position. And I was curious what the press tour for this movie was like. So I watched, and it was mostly just like 50 Cent and Gerard Butler being friends in a way that was like, I don't need to watch this. but I watched them, but they would also present the story in that way, like when introducing the movie. It's like, oh, you know, it's like a good guy, bad guy. It's kind of like Heat, a movie I've never seen, but I know is about cops.
Another long, boring, like, fuck that movie. Ugh.
but I just found it like, yeah, like that. This, at least the marketing narrative for this movie, even though there are lines like "we are the bad guys," is that the regulators are in fact the good guys, or that's the pitch. It's very, it's so. Mm-hmm. It made my head hurt.
And part of what, like, and we'll talk about this too, but the, well, what happens next in the story is that Nick's, his wife,
oh my gosh,
leaves him. because he's been cheating on her, but I feel like the women are there to like humanize Big Nick a bit and like make us feel empathy, or try to make the audience feel empathetic toward him. So that's happening. He's being divorced. And then meanwhile, Merriman, Donnie, and the rest of the Den of Thieves start making plans to rob the Los Angeles branch of the Federal Reserve, which is the only bank in LA that's never been successfully robbed because it's under such tight security. And their plan is that an average of $30 million in cash gets destroyed every day, which I was curious if that's true, because if it is, what a horrifying fact.
like, if it is, we should rob that.
We should rob the Federal Reserve.
Seriously. That's a great idea.
Just, they're literally throwing money away.
And maybe want to rob the Federal Reserve.
So they're planning to rob this $30 million in cash on this particular day, and it gets destroyed because it's considered like old and unfit. Which means that it's untraceable and no one's going to be looking for it. So they're going to try to steal it. Meanwhile, Nick and his crew of deputies start tailing Merriman's Den of Thieves. They're fucking with them. They're letting them know, you know, we're on to you. And then Donnie is kind of playing both sides. You know, he's telling the cops stuff about this heist. He's telling Merriman that he's been talking to the cops. You know, he's kind of in the middle.
This is where the part of the movie that I began to grow very confused. Like, the middle of this movie is really long, and I didn't understand what was going on well enough to tell when someone was lying about what was going on.
Right.
And ended up really becoming distressed. I did not know what was happening.
Right. And then, before the big heist, the Den of Thieves rob a small local bank, which Big Nick has been tipped off about. So he heads there. But the robbers, the Den of Thieves, they don't do their usual thing. This time they make demands, they take and kill hostages, or so we are led to believe. But wait a minute, turns out that this was all to create a diversion to distract the cops and give the Den of Thieves time to pull off the real heist at the Federal Reserve, which Nick eventually figures out is what's happening. And then we see the heist in progress. They use the armored truck that they stole to pose as, and I don't know if they're like guys who work for the Federal Reserve, or it's like some entity that like drops the money off at the reserve from the banks. So they pretend to be these guys. They drop off the money that they stole from this small bank at the Federal Reserve. Donnie is inside one of the containers of money, and then we see him do a bunch of heist stuff.
Those shots, you know, were fun. When they got him, like, in the little cube, you're like, oh, this is nice.
There are like 20 minutes of this movie that I was like, oh, because I love a heist movie. I love to watch a heist, and I was like, okay, this is fun. I'm enjoying this. they're cutting the power, you know, there's all that kind of heisty stuff.
It's all very national treasure. It's exciting.
So then Donnie gets the money that was going to be destroyed. He prevents it from being shredded. He puts it in bags and then he throws it in, I guess, like a trash chute. And then all of the Den of Thieves manage to escape. They hijack the dump truck and get the bags of money. But oh no, Big Nick and his deputies pick up Donnie. Then they find the rest of the robbers. There's this huge shootout with all of the Den of Thieves being
on a freeway.
Freeway. With like so many cars around them.
Many civilian casualties were, like, it seemed like there the highway was full of people, but then all of a sudden there were only the four main cast members. Like, it was so confusing.
Not sure. So they kill all the deputies, the sheriffs kill the Den of Thieves. But wait a minute, the money that they stole, it's not there. And then when Nick gets back to his car, Donnie has escaped because it turns out Donnie was the mastermind of the whole heist. He had been tricking everyone. He's the one who got the money. And then we cut to him in London with a British accent that I'm not sure how authentic or convincing it is. And he's, you know, he's planning another heist.
He goes, "Diamond then, exchange? Drinks on me, mate." You're like, okay, sure.
So that's the story. Let's take another quick break and then we'll come back to discuss.
Okay, we're back. I guess to start, Cerise, we sort of talked a little bit about the interrogation scene at the beginning of the movie already when they kidnapped Donnie. Were there other elements, regardless to start of how they're being framed, but were there other specifics about the LASD that jumped out to you in the way that this movie is kind of written and presented?
Yeah, I was really just like sort of like taken by like how many references to the gangs that there were in this movie. I mean, there's that scene where he shows the tattoo and he's beating Donnie. Donnie also makes reference to being incarcerated at Wayside, which is a facility that's home to another deputy gang called the Wayside Whiteys, which is like a KKK type gang that regularly terrorizes black inmates. So that was also just sort of like, huh, okay, like another open secret. Mm-hmm. Gerard Butler, Big Nick, when they're outside the bank and they're sort of running surveillance on this smaller bank that the Den of Thieves is going to rob, he says that they let it go down because the Den of Thieves had to commit a crime in order for them to do something. Mm-hmm. As soon as they got out of the car with those assault rifles, a crime was being committed. Which, I mean, it tracks as far as the LASD, just sort of like, you know, letting things happen and stepping in, you know, when they think it'll be to their advantage. There have been several cases like that that I've covered. Yeah, that seemed very realistic to me.
Wow. So this movie is written and directed by Christian Gudegast, who is, from what I can tell, he's soap opera nepotism, and also, Caitlin, relevant to our interest, the guy who plays John Jacob Astor in Titanic, Christian Gudegast, is his son. So he's also Titanic nepotism.
Whoa. John Jacob Astor, the richest man on the ship?
Famously the richest man on the ship. And R.I.P. Just kidding. He probably was horrible. But Christian Gudegast is nepotism of that. I would be really curious to know where his, because it does seem like you're saying, Cerise, he's referencing a lot of hyper specifics. And he grew up in LA, so I'm like, it mm-hmm. maybe is some cultural osmosis going on there. And then I also read that there was a former special agent that consulted on this movie as well. So it sounds like it's very possible that they had consulted someone who had been somehow affiliated with the LASD to make this movie, which sort of opens up something that I feel like we've talked about in passing over the years, which is that, you know, when you're writing about I feel like often when there's movies that are about cops or especially about the military, consultants are brought on who are very pro cop and pro military, and it's, you never see consultants being brought on to a movie like this that have the same knowledge base but would be perhaps critical of murder. Like I feel like we hear that all the time with I forget what the job title is, but there's like a high-ranking military person whose job is to work with Hollywood and say, okay, you can use our tanks and Transformers if you get A, B, and C, you know, sneak it into the movie. And mm-hmm. it's such a traceable pattern that I would guess whatever consulting was done on this movie is kind of the same thing is going on here. Yeah, right, I wish I knew more about the consulting process with this movie. It seems like people were really not interested in this movie because I couldn't find a lot about the production other than 50 Cent and Gerard Butler love going on talk shows together and chatting. That's all. But right. Yeah, I think that the consulting process on movies like this is really critical because it is it's bizarre that there's that level of specificity in a completely uncritical way.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would also argue that because I watched this movie for the first time before I had read any of the parts of your piece on these gangs in the sheriff's department in LA. And I don't know if I'm just dense, but like, I was aware of like just the trope of, you know, cops in movies, you know, being these kind of hard ass, I don't play by the rules, I do my own thing, and that's how I catch the bad guys, sort of just like mentalities, especially for the Big Nick character. But like the references to the gang he's in, like I just kind of missed that. You know, I know he's like pointing at a tattoo, but I don't know like what exactly that was in reference to. So even though there are these specific references, I think if you don't already have some kind of baseline of knowledge about these gangs in sheriff's departments, which I'd imagine the general public doesn't know that much about, which is why it's so important for everyone to read your writing, Cerise. But like, I was just like, oh, and so I didn't even connect the dots really until after I had read the parts that have been published so far of your writing. So, I ended up being just very surprised that, not surprised, but I was expecting, if there are going to be these references in the movie, that it would be more critical about it. But again, the framing of these deputy characters in the movie is like, yeah, they're grizzled, they're rough around the edges, they drink, they smoke, they cheat on their wives, they get divorced, you know, all these things, but ultimately at the end of the day they're good cops and they're doing good work, and we're supposed to be rooting for them. And even though the three of us watching this movie are not rooting for Big Nick and his deputies because of how we know all of the horror and terror and everything that cops inflict on the communities they're supposed to be protecting, they are not redeemable to us. But again, I think the movie is like framing them as like, nope, these are the good guys. See how empathetic they are. Oh, don't you feel bad for him? He's crying because he can't see his daughter. Like that kind of stuff.
God. Yeah. The way that daughters are bandied about in this goddamn movie is so, it is like the, you were referencing this earlier, Caitlin, but yeah, the way that the women in this movie are used are generally to endear you to a male character, especially the daughters mm-hmm. with Gerard. Oh my God, Gerard Butler, like, my daughter, my daughter,
my daughter.
I'm so sick of like these, like, just, oh God, my daughter culture, we gotta kill it. It's so boring and manipulative in the way that it's kind of weaponized, because you could take the my daughter of it all out of Gerard Butler's storyline, and the only result of it would be that you would like his character less, which this movie seems pretty invested in you remaining somehow, like, somewhat loyal to him. Mm-hmm. And then you kind of get a similar moment with 50 Cent's character, where, I don't know, in the way that the daughters are used, it's just so corny and tropey too, because for 50 Cent he's like, this is my daughter's prom date, you better not be mean to my daughter or all of my friends will kill you. And then he and it's like, God, it's so corny. It's a scene we've seen a bajillion times. It's scary and possessive. And then he closes the door and it's a Stadium Arcadium poster, and I'm like, what a twist. And the daughter never comes back, and like
you never see her again.
We don't even know how the prom went. I was invested.
I love how when Gerard Butler's daughter has a line on screen, the first thing she says to her father is, "What are you doing?"
I was like, same.
We're like,
know?
Valid question.
Yeah. That question, especially after, because his wife just said to him, like, you smell really bad. And then he got extremely close to his very young daughter. And I was like, ooh, this stinky Gerard Butler getting close to his kid. I don't know. I mean, I guess the one act of agency that a woman has in the whole movie is Gerard Butler's wife being like, nope, we're getting out of here. Mm-hmm. Which, again, was something that I thought, I don't know why I kept, like, I just, like, there were a few moments where I'm like, ooh, benefit of the doubt, maybe this is going somewhere, and then it never was. But I thought it was interesting, I guess interesting is as close as you'll get, but that they gave Gerard Butler, like, a disastrous home life, and they made it, like, the movie went really out of its way to show that he was just a plague to everyone in his personal life. Mm-hmm. And that he was pretty mm-hmm. like unloved by his family, which I feel like is, I mean, that's doesn't necessarily happen in all copaganda movies. A lot of times you have a cop that has a very well structured home life, and maybe he goes rogue a little bit, and maybe he like fucks around with other women, but he still has this like nuclear family unit. But that's not, I mean, that's very much not the case for him. I was wondering, because there is such a like well-documented high rate of domestic abuse and coming from cops, usually to their wives, but just to their spouses in general, I was like, is that where this is going? But then it turns mm-hmm. out it was going actually nowhere.
Yeah, there's that very long scene where he like shows up to his wife's like little dinner party with her other friends.
What was going on there?
And he's like terrorizing everybody, and I'm just like, again, like, who are we supposed to be rooting for in this movie? Because everyone's so toxic and awful.
I think that was supposed to sort of like put her in a bad light, right? Because she was there with her boyfriend, and mm-hmm. which I think was supposed to be implied, oh, like, she's been unfaithful as well. Everyone is
right. And yeah. like when you first meet her, it's in the same scene that she's leaving him. Mm-hmm. So again, like, I look at that, I'm like, yes, you were clearly very justified in leaving this very shitty person.
Why did you marry this person is my question.
But the way that these scenes like this get framed in movies, in like just sort of the way that storytelling manipulates audiences, is it makes us like, we're not meant to like that his wife character or side with her because of like she's doing something mean to the guy that we're supposed to be rooting for. So yeah, and then he just shows up at his daughter's like playground at school, and creepy. Why are no teachers being like, who is this man? Don't talk to this weird man who's lingering at a playground. Like, what?
It's anyway. So, like, yeah, him lingering in a playground was, I was like, oh, I need, get me out of here. Get me out of here. I don't want to be here anymore. I was so confused. I was like, what are we supposed to, in what world is this going to endear you to this man? And then I was just like, well, you know, we're clearly not the target audience for this movie. I'm just like, I want to talk to whoever the target movie, like, who is the target audience for this movie? And I would like to have a word with them because they have a twisted mind. The way that, and that's mainly, I mean, that's kind of the only way that, in terms of talking about, like, I mean, this movie obviously doesn't pass the Bechdel test. Like, women are just there to make you feel a way about a good guy or a bad guy. And I think, well, the other female characters you have a number of sex workers who are presented nameless, faceless, usually as set mm-hmm. dressing.
Yes.
And either to be shamed or to be set dressing. And then you have, what's his name? Liev Schreiber's brother. Merriman. Merriman's girlfriend or his wife. I'm not sure which.
Wait, he's Liev Schreiber's oh my gosh, yeah.
There's a lot of nepotism going on in this. I mean, it's nepotism top to bottom. Except, well, actually, I guess Liev Schreiber's brother and O'Shea Jackson Jr. is Ice Cube's son. Mm-hmm. And Christian Gudegast is John Jacob Astor from Titanic's son. So, whatever. Nepotism fuels the world. We know this.
Yes.
But, yeah, so that Merriman's partner, I don't know, like, really what their relationship is because the movie doesn't tell you. But he weaponizes her as well and kind of sends her out on... Can someone explain to me what was going on there? Because I was confused.
Unclear. That's another thing that didn't really make any sense. Okay. I feel like she seduced him, and in that interaction, she was able to... She informed him where the robbery was going to be, but, like, I don't really... That part didn't really make sense to me. Like, why would that come up, like, in a tryst? Like, I think, oh, my boyfriend's robbing a bank. Like,
hey, are you a sheriff? Because you might want to know about this.
Right. Yeah.
What?
You learn that Merriman puts her up to it, and, like, he tells her to deliberately give him this information so that those deputies go to that place so that they are adequately distracted from the real heist. But right, like, so it's this he's like pimping out his girlfriend to, like, be better at crimes, and I'm just like, oh my god. And then there's that scene where there's like a dick measuring contest at the shooting range between Merriman and Gerard Butler, and they're just like, I can shoot my gun better than you. Who is this movie
but it
for?
Seems like that is like cop culture in like just the embarrassing dick measuring hyper masculine cowboy culture is so I don't it's so I guess I'm curious about your thoughts on that too, Cerise, where it's like, it seems like these two things kind of feed into each other in this very insidious way, where it's like all media surrounding cops reinforce this cowboy mentality. And I mean, there's countless examples of people who decide they want to become cops based off of watching movies like this. And then it sounds like based on your reporting that the culture that actually exists very much reflects that. It just seems like a kind of a snake eating its own tail in terms of how the culture works there.
Yeah, I think you summed it up perfectly. I mean, everything that was depicted in this movie, like, that kind of stuff is celebrated in law enforcement. You know, like, after there's a shooting, a lot of the times they're going out and having drinks and, you know, celebrating it. I think you very much hit it on the head. Like, a lot of people, unfortunately, I think, join law enforcement so they can participate in stuff like this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and like fulfill this, you know, whatever, it seems like a dominant fantasy, basically.
Right.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, I mean, again, framing is everything. The way these characters are framed in media is often like, wow, they're so cool. They're such badasses. You know, they play by their own rules. They're the heroes. They're like, you know, quote unquote, saving the day. And it just perpetuates this cycle of propaganda.
Yeah.
Ooh.
It's not good. It's I'll say it, I don't like it.
Wow, brave.
Yeah, thank you. And I also thought it was like a very deliberate choice to make the Den of Thieves, the, you know, who the movie wants you to feel like are the bad guys, to make them all veterans as well, is like, I think, a very tropey and deliberate choice. They were very it was a specific branch. They were from MARSOC, Marine Veterans.
Special Forces. Yes.
Right. And so it's like there's also this other narrative that's kind of going on there that implies that, you know, veterans are inclined to behave a type of way in a way that's just, I don't know, it's obviously extremely unnuanced, but it doesn't really, I mean, this movie interrogates nothing except, like, why does Gerard Butler look so bad? But, and the other big question, does 50 Cent listen to Stadium Arcadium? But in terms of, like, really intentionally choosing, I feel like it's really tropey to be like, oh, he's an ex-Marine, so of course he's, like, really tough and really violent, without interrogating, like, well, where does that trope come from? And can the government not be held to account as being extremely complicit in Marine violence and then providing veterans with no resources, or job prospects often once they're out of the forces? And just, I don't know, that kind of pinged me as well of like, oh, of course, yeah, this movie is going to be poorly written enough just to be like, ex-Marine, sure, sounds good.
Yeah.
Are there, I was like, we definitely ran out of women. I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, is there anything you'd like to add about anything, Cerise? Or I guess I'm specifically interested in your thoughts on how media can handle the representation of law enforcement and that kind of thing more responsibly, or in a way that is just more critical and shedding light on the like very often racially charged violence that they're inflicting on individuals and communities. Any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think we just need to stop having movies like this, right? I mean, it's yeah, and I don't think police violence should be glorified in movies. Like, I definitely think, like, there's perhaps a way to, you know, have films that discuss the terror that police inflict on communities, but it's done in such a way that it's, you know, amplifying the voices of the people that survived the horror and, you know, speaking about the implications of that and the toll that it's taken on their lives. I'm much more interested in seeing that rather than some asshole with a gun, you know, use the R word and kill a bunch of people and then go home and collect a pension.
I think one of the few movies I've seen about that, or like from that perspective, would be Straight Outta Compton, The Hate U Give, and then maybe a handful of others, but they're just, yeah, those stories just aren't being told nearly as often as all of these propaganda movies, because there's just so many of them, and a lot of them, like, I'm like, damn it, this is a movie that I like, but it's about cops, and I just have to, there's just like so much of that I've had to unlearn.
I think it does come into, like, there are, you know, there is media that exists that is critical of police, but they're also just like not funded or promoted to anywhere near the same extent. Like, no one has ever heard of Den of Thieves, and yet it made $80 million. Like, it is such an industry as well that it's like, it I don't know. It feels so frustrating and so hopeless. And I think that there is potential, especially when reporting like yours comes out, Cerise, that it's like the more that the public is generally aware that this is just total bullshit that we've kind of been spoon fed as like easy content to consume, that hopefully that, you know, the desires of the general public will change and be less open and accommodating and willing to just fork over money to stuff like this. Mm-hmm. It's very dark. And then it's also just like so intuitive in the same way that it's just like, yeah, if you want to make a movie that's an accurate depiction of what, like, it's just the idea that the only option is to center and consult cops. Like, in what world are you going to come out with something that isn't just promoting cops? And it just seems like that is that's the media habit we're stuck in. And it's only recently kind of being questioned. I mean, it's like, mm-hmm. Dogs Are Cops. That's like the most popular show for children is Cop Dogs.
Yeah.
And I feel like in the last several years, there's been so many different takes on copaganda. There's so many ways to come at that discussion. But it just seems like, yeah, like movies like Den of Thieves don't serve anyone. Like, it's just kind of garbage. And
yeah, it's like referencing these gangs that Christian, whatever the shit his name is,
Gudegast,
is aware of, but then doing absolutely nothing to like criticize or comment on the behavior. I mean, aside from, you know, they're showing these deputies, like, you know, roughing up Donnie and they do a big shootout and murder a lot of people. But again, it's all about the framing. It's like, well, they were bad guys. They were robbers.
And that framing
so
of,
they're
like,
justified.
At the end, when Big Nick kills Liev Schreiber's brother, the way that it's framed is like, and this is like so hard for him, and he doesn't actually want to do it, he has to do it. And it's like, mm-hmm. No one has to murder anybody. And and the disingenuous framing of like, oh, don't you feel for this guy because he has to murder, it's like,
right.
I don't know. Yeah, it makes my head hurt. But it's like, but it is so normalized in that genre that when you watch it unfold, these characters who literally admit to being the villain repeatedly, it's so stuck into this genre that it's like, well, even if they say they're the villain, they're actually not, and we love them, and we're going to market it like that, and we're going to make $80 million fucking dollars. So...
yeah.
On that note, it doesn't pass the Bechdel test. It really doesn't.
No.
Nowhere close.
Not even.
Sorry.
It does pass the Stadium Arcadium test, which most movies don't.
Oh, yeah.
So that's positive.
And then as far as our nipple scale, 0 to 5 nipples based on an intersectional examination of the movie, I'll just go ahead and give this 0 nipples. I don't think it really deserves anything. Yeah.
Let's give it a 0. Yeah, that's going to be a 0.
Would you like to rate it? Sorry.
It was horrible. I mean,
I am genuinely very happy that you brought this to us, though, because this is not normally the movie that we would cover, and like, we just don't cover this genre very much, but it is definitely like important to talk about because a lot of people watch these movies like religiously, and mm-hmm. it definitely affects, I mean, it unquestionably affects the way that they view law enforcement and what they're like willing to permit from law enforcement, because like you pointed out, the most famous cop characters are constantly being terrible cops, like,
And that's a part of the glorified image. And so much of the incredible reporting you've been releasing reflects that to an absolutely horrific extent. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yes. Thank you so much for having me.
We really appreciate it. Thank you for bringing us feminist masterpiece Den of Thieves.
Oh, my new favorite movie. I would have never discovered this without you, so thank you so much.
And where can we find your work and where can we find this series you're releasing? This episode's going to come out tomorrow.
Yeah, you can follow me on Twitter at Cerise Castle, and you can find me on Instagram by, you know, typing that in as well. And you can read the series on the Deputy Gangs at knock.la tomorrow or today when this podcast is dropping. We will actually be releasing our chapter about the Regulators, so you can read all about the gang.
Timing.
Yes, perfect timing. So head over there and you can read all about the Deputy Gang that Big Nick was in and all the horrible shit that they do.
God damn. Thank you so much for coming. Thank you so much for the incredible reporting that you're doing. And yeah, I guess you can find the Bechdel cast in all the regular places, the Twitter, the Instagram.
You can, the Patreon, etc.
Yeah.
But yeah, please read the reporting that Cerise has done, is continuing to do, and the Patreon. Can you plug the Patreon again for Knock LA?
Oh yeah. Or please support our Knock Patreon. Like I said, this work it costs a lot of money to do, and I'd like to keep doing it. So anything that you can spare is much appreciated.
Yes, please.
And with that, thanks for listening. Come back next week because we have, I think, maybe our most impactful episode that we've ever released is coming out next week. So definitely
return
for that.
Right. It's
going to be a
very
major.
Important.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.